Grosso from Vancouver to win it for Canada! Canada came! Canada conquered! Canada gold!
Buchanan with the cross in towards Alphonso Davies! Canada's history-making moment delivered by their biggest superstar! A goal the country has been dreaming about for decades! Finally arrives!
You're listening to the Northern Football Podcast with Peter Galindo, Alexander Gonge-Rujic, and your host, Ben Steiner.
Hey there, folks, and welcome back into the Northern Football Podcast. It's episode 134 of NFP, and we've got the World Cup in the rear view, at least for Canada. So back to our usual shtick here on the show, covering everything Canadian soccer. Ben Steiner alongside Alex Gonge-Rujic and Peter Galindo. Make sure to rate, review, and subscribe, and follow us on all platforms at Northern Football and Northern Football wherever you get your podcasts. But some international news on the Canadian front. Canada will play Japan, and that's some good news for the men's national team. They're going to play in Japan on October 13 ahead of the Nations League quarterfinals. But on the flip side, General Secretary Jason DeVos stated that there won't be any September friendlies, I guess, unless something of a miracle happens for the Canadian program, saying, given our inability to confirm an additional high-quality opponent in the September window that met our competitive needs, as well as financial constraints, we were unable to secure fixtures for both windows. And I think when you look at that, first of all, how are you guys? And when you look at that, it's a little unfortunate for the Canadian team, but kind of expected.
It is, yeah. Disappointing, obviously. And it's one of those where, and we're going to get into all this, I'm sure, but it's one of those where, you know, you're not surprised, but you're still disappointed because you were kind of hoping something would come of it. And I think DeVos also told the Canadian press that there were opportunities in September when you go back to as early as like May, but he had only been in the position for about a week at that point. And there was just too much going on for them to confirm it. Now, I don't know who those countries could have been. Could it have been France? Could it have been Germany? We don't know. We probably never will know. Still disappointing that it didn't end up happening. At least they got Japan in the end. It's a top 20 nation, a pretty solid World Cup team. We saw the things they were able to do at the last World Cup against Canada themselves. And this time they're going to have their full complement of players as well, unlike the last time when half of their 11 was missing in the first half. So this will at least be a solid test, but definitely not ideal when you look at the fact that there's going to be some pretty pivotal Nations League quarterfinals coming up for Canada in all likelihood.
Yeah, I mean, it's more of just, the frustration, I guess, is that you can't continue to build or capitalize on any sort of momentum as well, because that's a huge gap, really. Because, I mean, Japan, it's going to be a great matchup, no doubt. You go on the road. Certainly for Canada, it'd be nice to get outside CONCACAF and get a test, but you would have liked more tests, right? Just the double window, get that chance to build chemistry, get opportunities, ditto with the lack of September friendlies as well, because I think for Canada they need these sorts of matches just to experiment, to really get that next generation embedded, because it's been so many non-stop competitive games for a couple of years. These sorts of friendlies can be crucial to provide that opportunity, especially because you got the privilege, I guess, of skipping Nations League group stage play ahead of the quarterfinals in the fall for Copa America. This was a free chance to experiment, and really you're not gaining anything, because especially now you're going to be playing a team in the quarterfinal that will be fresh and prepared. And, you know, as we saw maybe on the women's side, where, you know, there's a lot of talk of, does preparation affect play, etc., while heading into a must-win Copa America qualifiers. It's something where you don't want to be testing that sort of fate. You don't want to be opening up that sort of discussion again. And obviously there's financial constraints with hosting friendlies. If you're hosting, you're eating a large chunk of revenue, unless you're pulling in a certain kind of opponent. And I mean, ditto going out on the road, it's not always easy, but you would have wondered, even if it was two friendlies of, you're not playing maybe a top 30 nation, but even a top 50, top 60, top 70 nation in September. I mean, that's what the US is doing. And then in October, just finding a second game, you would have hoped that there was an opportunity for that, because it'll feel like a missed opportunity. And hey, who knows? The language in Jason DeVos's statement was very ambiguous, because he did say there won't be any September friendlies, but then they kept using the words "for now" in their statement. So maybe that's, you know, them potentially throwing a branch, but maybe we're reaching there. And really, if it is one game, well, that's a huge disappointment. No other way to put it.
And from Steve at Binatch 2, the men's national team needs to play against top tiers to improve. This won't happen until perhaps the Copa America. Again, playing in a tournament with little experience against top teams. Am I overreacting if I'm thinking this golden generation is being put into a downward spiral? I think it's too early to say that, even though we've been dealing with this for, I guess, 15 months now. But yes, that can become a concern that you're sort of wasting this group of players and their potential with the national team. But then again, you can approach the 2026 World Cup, and if they make the quarterfinals of the World Cup, they catch lightning in a bottle. Is it a wasted generation, or is that as good as Canada can get?
That's fair. And I do think that downward spiral is probably a bit aggressive at this point, but based on how 2023 has gone for our national teams, you're not unjustified to think that. You know, John's warning post Nations League final, saying that we need to get real and give the teams the resources we need to succeed. You're starting to see that negative side starting to seep in now, because it's just the one match, albeit against a quality opponent, to prepare for Nations League quarterfinals against, in all likelihood, Jamaica or Panama, who are going to play four matches in September and October, which, based on that, leaves Canada at a disadvantage. We know the Federation is in a tough place, and Jason DeVos is in an unenviable position given the hand he was dealt, but this clearly isn't good for the preparation, and it's doing this tremendous group of players and staff a bit of a disservice, right? The only positive thing is that friendlies can hurt your FIFA ranking compared to competitive games due to how they're weighed. So in the future, this could help Canada if we qualify for Copa America and get a better seating for the draw. Things like that. Jamaica and Panama, yes, they do have four games, but it's against lower quality opposition, so at least they're not getting those reps against elite teams. So maybe by the time they come up against a Canada, they're a little complacent, or they're not used to facing more polished sides, and then maybe that gives Canada an advantage. But when you look at just specifically the close to this to this calendar year, at least on the men's side, and certainly we can look at the women's side, and I guess there's still a little bit of a TBD there, just given the Olympic playoff and whatnot, but you look at 2023 as a whole, and you're like, yeah, this is really not panned out at all like we had hoped for it to have panned out, especially when you look at the highs of 2022, even amidst the start of the labor dispute.
Yeah, it feels, well, downward spiral certainly would be a strong word, but yeah, I think it's something where you're not setting up your team for success. And I think that's something where, obviously, as we see across global soccer, sometimes your team will succeed despite, you know, its circumstances. But yeah, it's something where if you're not setting up your national team for success, you can only wonder what sort of impact it will have going forward. And yeah, it's just... It's something where you do wonder the effect it's having in certain aspects. I mean, for example, transfers. I mean, this summer has been a lot quieter summer for Canadian men's national team transfers, especially compared to 22, where so much was happening. And, you know, you can only wonder, of course, international soccer doesn't play all that much. Teams aren't foolish, say, but also teams are foolish. They love to get drawn into things such as, you know, great international tournament, or, you know, little things like that. And you know, when Canada builds up a bit of a reputation as a team that's a bit in disarray, a bit of chaos, those sorts of biases, those sorts of things can weigh against, you know, scouts, especially old school scouts that still believe that sort of stuff. And it's just all that to say, there's like little things where you do wonder if it is hurting Canada, where, you know, you look at 22 and it was such a positive year, at least to start. And then you look some of the transfers, you like things are moving on the up. And then you compare it to this year, or even at the club level, it feels like some Canadians have perhaps suffered from, you know, the impacts of everything. You only wonder what sort of impact that is having.
And from Owen W at @_Owen_W, how will expectations change for the Canadian men's national team going into November's Nations League quarterfinals while only playing one friendly over four possible match days? I think we're going to see a lot of the same trope from John Herdman in his addresses to the media of lacking preparation and kind of going into these tournaments without much ability to train, to have this group get ready for these matches. But in terms of how they're going to perform and the expectations, I think as Canadian soccer fans, generally, we're putting our expectations quite high for this team at this point. And so when you're looking at that, you're looking at getting through the quarterfinal. I think that that has to be the only acceptable way of going. And if you don't get through the quarterfinal, you have to look at massive repercussions within your player pool, your staff, just everything. Because if you don't get through that quarterfinal, it's disastrous.
But there's still a second chance to qualify for Copa America. So it's not like it's completely disastrous.
It's still pretty disastrous.
Yeah. Well, I do think regardless, even if Canada had played in all four match days or just one match day, as we're seeing now, the expectations are still pretty much the same. It's still going to be a very tough matchup against Jamaica or Panama, which are going to be the likeliest opponents at this stage, whether Canada is seated third or fourth among the four already qualified teams. But it's certainly something that fans should remember when it comes to preparation. Like, I've seen firsthand what an extra training session or two can do for a squad, let alone an extra game or two. And when you have a team like Jamaica who have brought in a couple more dual nationals, they finally have their full complement of players available. They only really got the Gold Cup to test it out in a competitive setting. That's going to have a bit of an impact, of course. For Panama, maybe not so much because they've already got their established team and we already know what they're going to present us. But overall, when you look at preparation time, you know, the U.S. got, I believe it was 10 days to prepare for the Nations League finals. Canada had 4 to prepare for Nations League. And before people say, well, that wasn't an excuse during qualifying, why wasn't that touted out by Herdman during qualifying? That's because every other country dealt with 3-game windows, tight turnarounds, lots of travel, few training sessions. It was an even playing field. Once it came down to, hey, the federations can determine all of their preparation before the window and during the window, you're starting to see the discrepancy in resources and overall expenditure. And that certainly reared its ugly head against the U.S., who clearly had much more time to prepare and obviously a much greater pool of resources to choose from. Canada's still going to be favored in that quarterfinal, but the gap will be slightly narrowed given the extra games played for either of those two teams. As I said before, they're not going to be playing elite opposition, so that might benefit Canada in the end. Jamaica has better individual talent than Panama, mainly up front, but in midfield and defense, you could say Canada is level or superior still, depending on what area we're talking about. And we know that defensively in open play, they've been quite solid in CONCACAF. We'll see what these extra 3 games will do come November. But the chance to nail your tactical platforms, gaining chemistry, etc., that's all going to be super valuable. And it's certainly something worth remembering come November when we start to look at both teams.
Yeah, well, it's something where it is disastrous, though, I'd say. Just because for Canada, it was laid out so nicely for them in the sense that playing in Copa America next year is going to be massive if you want to preparing for a 2026 World Cup. You get a chance to go into a competitive environment, you know, a pool of teams that includes the defending World Cup champions, some of the top teams in the world. If just squandering that first and foremost would be a disaster. And it is something where, I mean, perhaps, yeah, certainly Canada's preparation is going to affect expectations. And that's probably the frustrating part, is that you're heading into an opportunity like this and you're not fully maximizing the chance to play these sorts of crucial games and to create a bit of a leveler for yourself. I think it's something still, despite that, I think Canada, I mean, again, we have to see how this draw ends up shaping up. You'd still think they have a lot of, they'd have an advantage over most opponents they face as long as they avoid, say, like a Jamaica or perhaps even a Panama given their form. But yeah, I think that's frustrating that even you're looking at 2 games like this where, you know, maybe when this format was laid out, you're like, oh, Canada's going to get some good September and October preparation. They're going to head in this game in a good mood, in a good form, start preparing for 2026. And I guess that's also where it goes back to the federation level, that they're kind of putting their team in this chance because, yeah, these Copa America games, you have to get there. You have to get there with confidence because it's a huge tournament. If anything close to a slip up will feel like a disaster, especially if it's one where it's self-inflicted or it's not even as much as across 2 legs, you just get unlucky, you end up losing to a team that's better on the day. Well, for Canada, the fact that they're kind of setting themselves up for something like that to happen is frustrating because, yeah, you know, you can trip over your shoelaces sometimes, right? They're going to get undone. But if you're tying them together and trying to run with it, like you're kind of doing it to yourself. And that's probably the most frustrating thing about all of this.
And from Matthew H at Kenneman T100 always, and Matthew overwhelmingly with the questions this week, based on the October friendly timeline, is it fair to expect more European players, or is MLS still a good shout even after a long, heavy season and some possible playoff teams?
No, I'm sure, say, the Whitecaps won't be thrilled if Richie and Sam have to fly 10 hours across the Pacific and back again during a playoff run. That's not to say they wouldn't go, but you're probably going to face some complications with situations like that. But even direct flights from Europe to Japan are super long. Like, you're talking 12 plus hours for a direct flight from certain cities. So I'm sure some of the European clubs will be hesitant to release guys, especially if it's just for one friendly in Asia. But the fact there are no September games will help with that. At least everybody's going to stay put, and maybe they'll get some brownie points that way. But I think you're going to expect a pretty European heavy roster just based on the fact that MLS, it's going to be playoff time or end of regular season time, and teams are going to want to have their full complement of players available for that stretch run.
But then again, you also look at sort of how you get to Japan, and especially when you're thinking of MLS players, you generally would go through Vancouver. And so Richie and Sam would be the closest players to Japan from MLS. And so, yeah, you would think you would probably see a European heavy roster, but Richie Leray and Sam Adekubi, they're fully capable of getting there, even if Vancouver's sort of prepping for a run like that.
Well, they are. I'm just saying that they're not going to probably want to let them go if they're fighting for playoff seeding or the playoff start.
For sure.
They're not going to be happy with them flying across the Atlantic or across the Pacific, sorry, and then back again. That's not to say they can't do it. In fact, it's probably the shortest flight among all the European players available. In fact, all the players available. It's going to be the shortest flight, but that still doesn't mean they're going to be happy with them going.
At the same time, I mean, these are valuable preparation games for Canada. I guess that's an advantage of a one game window, is that maybe it's not as, you know, you're not pushing right up against games on either end of the window as well. Club games, sometimes that can have an impact, but I still think it's something for Canada. Yeah, given the importance, and it's also a window where you must release players, even though if it is friendlies. Yeah, of course, there's always going to be those negotiations with club. But I think given that it's one game, I'd find it hard to say that they're, it would be much of an obstacle, because we've seen a lot of top national teams play in Japan recently, like Brazil in their preparation to the World Cup. They headed to Asia and, you know, played, certainly played South Korea, you know, et cetera. So it's something where it shouldn't be too much of a hindrance. And yeah, I mean, I guess maybe if anything, Vancouver could also, you know, the fact that Adekugbe and Leray are there could be a bit of an advantage, given that, you know, Vancouver is a bit of a port away city or gateway city to over to Asia. But no, I think in terms of the importance of this window, I don't think it'll be that much of an obstacle, but I guess we'll remain to be seen.
And from Ramsey at Ramsey_Y_Y, why exactly is Canada Soccer unable to schedule more than one friendly in the September/October international window? Why can't CSB step up if it's due to lack of funding? And I think that's a misconception about what CSB is. They're not necessarily filling their pockets with all the sponsorship money that they're taking in from Canada Soccer and the other programs. They're spending it on the CPL. They're spending it on various other footballing activities for the most part. Yes, they are putting some money in their pockets, but the CPL and CSB continuously loses money. And so there's not just money that you can draw on to book an Argentina at home. There's not just money you can draw on to get those higher quality opponents, because they're not filling their pockets. There's not this massive amount of money that's gone somewhere else. It's going to the CPL. It's helping grow Canadian players. And I think that's a misconception. And that can come down to a lot of the reporting that has surrounded this as well, where the CPL owners and CSB in general has been painted into this corner of stealing money from Canada Soccer. They're not necessarily stealing money. They're putting it towards the Canadian League, which has already developed players to the national team. They're not making money. There's not any more money to come towards national team programs or the CPL, money is being lost. The best you can do to help out the situation is go to CPL games, buy a ticket wherever you are. And when the CPL starts to make more money, then maybe CSB can help with the national teams.
Or they just continue to, at least what they say they're doing, to continue to slowly release more funds into Canada soccer as well. But there are a lot of factors that go into scheduling a friendly, right? It's what the other federation wants is a payment, a starting payment, that is, the gate splits, potential venues, travel expenses. Like, camps are not cheap at all to put on for anybody. So those were certainly factors. It wasn't for a lack of trying, clearly, based on the reporting that's out there. Some of it was just unfortunate timing with DeVos coming into the role, and then there was this opportunity to play in September, but he had so many other things to deal with that it just sort of fell through the cracks. Those certainly affected things, but it's not as simple as just calling up a team and saying, all right, do you want to play? Like, there's so many things that go into it. Like, sometimes you have backups for the backup, right? Which I'm sure happens all the time, even for the biggest federations in the world, right? Even for someone as in demand as Argentina. I know they're not going to be playing because they got CONMEBOL qualifiers to do, but like, I'm just saying, if they were free in this window, they would also be dealing with the same things that every other federation would be dealing with.
Yeah, ultimately, you know, it's one of those things where a lot of parties, I guess, to a lot of blame, I guess, to go around. And that's certainly something where you see the frustration of a lack of, you know, games. It's something where, yeah, like the CSB, a lot of that is going into not just the CPL as well. You look at League One Canada and some of the strides that's going on there to build, you know, some much needed infrastructure on both the men's and women's side to fill some gaps that are there as well. That's a huge aspect of it. And it's certainly something where, yeah, there also needs to be a look at where are, you know, where's Canada Soccer getting these resources from to host youth camps, to, you know, because there's obviously some big youth tournaments coming up to host these much needed friendlies to best prepare for everything to come on the men's and women's side. But ultimately, as we've seen, the answer isn't as easy as just take money from X point and put it in Y point. There's a lot more, I guess, factors to dive into. And that also, you know, it comes down also to the federational level, that where are they, you know, where are they getting this sort of money from, and where are they getting these sorts of cash streams from? And yeah, it's something where we want to all have the easy answer, but ultimately you look at it, there is no easy solution.
And from Fort McMurray, Can PL fan at FC_Fort, is the CSA trigger shy to have more home friendlies because of the forfeited Iran and Panama matches? That must have cost a pretty penny. I don't think they're necessarily hesitant. They want more matches. But if they got the money from the Iran match, if they got the money from the Panama match, or I guess one of those, more so the Iran match, there would be a little bit more flexibility. You might have seen another international friendly ahead of the World Cup, ahead of various other tournaments. Just there might have been more training days, more flexibility, because you would have filled 54,000 inside BC Place and attracted a lot more people to your brand when you put on a good performance against Iran as well. And from Amrit Pal Ugra at Amrit1217, will the U17 World Cup be in jeopardy with all this news? And I think when it comes to World Cups, Canada will send their teams to World Cups.
Absolutely. I think it's something where it's a crucial venture. I mean, on the flip side, you can only wonder if there's preparation time being missed out again, like, you know, camps. There's some fascinating U17 players, as we saw at the in the qualifiers, where it was a very, you know, TFC, Montreal, Vancouver based team. And even there were some interesting players. But then you see some of the, you know, names that have popped out since then. I mean, of course, just off the top of your head, you got, you know, TJ Tahid over at Vancouver FC, someone who's eligible. You wonder if he could have used a camp. You look across Europe, there's certainly some intriguing players in European academies popping on you would have liked to see. But certainly, I think, it's something where Canada will be going to the World Cup, and hopefully they can make the most of that preparation time they got earlier this year. Maybe that familiarity that some of these guys have in their clubs. I know some of the Montreal guys have been playing in the PLSQ, did it with some of the Whitecaps guys in League One, and even, you know, professionally with someone like Ajeeb and Badwal. So certainly they're getting those reps, but yeah, it's something. Well, they will play in the World Cup, but again, lack of preparation time, and that might end up being a bit of a theme.
And getting into Canada's under 15s, Canada is out of the CONCACAF U15 championships after losing 1-0 to Haiti, mirroring the senior team a few years back. Perfect 3-0 group stage after a 1-0 win against Panama on Tuesday. Losing to Haiti, not the way you want to go out of a CONCACAF tournament, but some promising things about this Canadian U15 team.
Yep, played some lovely stuff. They have a few players, including Richard Chukwu, who hilariously played for the under-17s, was still eligible for this tournament. They have himself. They got a few other players in that group who are looking really promising. But look, everybody at U15 level is at the same talent ability. It's just about how do they pan out over the next 3 to 5 years. And that's really going to be the crucial thing, right? But the fact that they played, I think, some aesthetically pleasing football is certainly the big takeaway. Even though they did end up losing, there's a lot that they can be proud of just in terms of how they played in a lot of these games, which is more than we can say about some of the other youth national teams over the last 5 years at various levels.
Yeah, it was really, you know, it's such a bright start to the tournament. Really, it's the only, you know, blemish, I guess, is just the frustration in which you lose to Haiti in the end. I mean, again, Haiti continues to be a team that will certainly elicit certain memories for Canadian fans now, but Haiti is also an intriguing one because they produce talent despite everything that goes on and that's been going on in that country. I mean, talent continues to pop out of Haiti. So certainly, you know, not the worst team to go out against, but still something where they'll feel that they, after the bright start to the tournament they had, Canada could have gone all the way and gotten something out of it. But ultimately, some bright flashes. And again, you just want to see this group of players get more reps together to build up and get across the systems. But that'll ultimately come back to the idea of, you know, more youth camps, etc.
Canadian MLS teams also in action recently in Leagues Cup competition, a competition that's been absolutely ridiculous in terms of everything that's happened in it. The Athletic doing some good roundups on that. But from the Vancouver Whitecaps, eliminated in the Leagues Cup after a 4-2 loss on penalties by Tigres in the round of 32 last Friday. An entertaining one that. They were the lone Canadian team left, while TFC and CF Montreal bowed out at the group stage. No Canadian MLS team will play again until next weekend, but it's a busy transfer window for the Vancouver Whitecaps in particular, as well as Canada's teams in general. Vancouver signed Richie Larea on a loan from Nottingham Forest. Of course, he comes over from TFC as well. And Sam Adekubi, after trading Julian Gressel to Columbus and loaning Deber Caicedo to Junior in Colombia. TFC signed South African winger Cassius Malula, loan midfielder Franco Ibarra from Atlanta, acquired midfielder Latif Blessing from New England for Marc-Anthony Kay, and signed striker Prince Oseowusu from Jan Regensburg on a free and loaned Ayo Akinola to the San Jose Earthquakes. CF Montreal acquired forward Kwasi Opoku from LAFC for $1.75 million in general allocation money and traded veteran center back Rudy Camacho to Columbus for $400,000 in GAM as well. And from Herbert Makula at Herbert Makula, what are your thoughts on Larea and Adekubi joining Vancouver? Despite me hurting as a TFC fan, I'm super excited for the Whitecaps and hope they can make an MLS Cup run. This could also benefit the chemistry of the national team, given how well Larea and Ahmed worked together at the Gold Cup.
Yeah, I mean, it's great signings for Vancouver, no doubt. The two positions in need at fullback / wingback, depending where they actually end up slotting in. I mean, it's a no-brainer for them. I mean, we've certainly... That one's been dove into at length. But really the big question is, yeah, how does it affect Canada? It is a bit of an intriguing one because, yeah, John Herdman has pushed for his men's national team players to push to the top leagues of Europe. Larea, you know, certainly was there. He was a Premier League contracted player. Was he going to play in the Premier League this season? Probably not. But still, maybe he have secured a loan to the championship or something else. Ditto with Adekugbe after a stint at Galatasaray. But also the most intriguing thing I think for me about this whole deal is just what it means about MLS, that, you know, it's all of a sudden being with the Lionel Messi signing and all those other moves as of late, all of a sudden MLS is becoming a more and more attractive play or league to certain players, especially those who are on Canadian and American national teams. So I'll be interested to see how, first and foremost, how that affects, say, someone like Adekugbe was in good form in Europe for a few years, to see if, okay, if you get good form in MLS, how much it affects. But certainly the chemistry thing is a big one, that Larrea and Adekugbe can get that continued familiarity. They can work with Ali Ahmed as well. And I think we could see a shift now where, you know, before it was very much get to Europe at all costs. But as we've seen sometimes with moves like Liam Fraser's and others, that's not always, you know, sometimes it can pan out, sometimes it might not. Whereas if MLS continues to grow, it might be seen as an alternative to some of these moves. Whereas unless you're moving to a top five league straight out of, you know, MLS, or a top club in a top league, it might be worth it to stay and grow and play in that league. And players like Larrea and Adekugbe coming back to the league only reinforced that notion.
And from Hayo Lyndon Hay, thoughts on Vanni Sartini getting a new contract? Axel has made it clear that he wants short-term success in Vancouver leading up to the 2026 World Cup, especially with these new signings. But I still wonder if Vanni fits into this equation. And I think when you look at the two new signings in Adekugbe and Larrea, they're to Vanny's system. They're to the way that Vanni has been playing with this team, using wingbacks, using either three at the back, or potentially sort of shifting Ahmed into that eight role and using the fullbacks in that way. So I think he is the coach to take a shot at a long run for Vancouver. And I don't think there's necessarily desire to reset that at the moment.
No, and I think it's something where he'll get his chance now, because he's continued to progress. He's continued to grow. He's won two trophies. You know, this Whitecap team has grown a lot. And I think now really this is his chance to, he's got about as complete of a roster as he's had, right? Like, he's just continued. Axel Schuster's done what Vanny's needed in terms of plugging holes. They needed, you know, it's a striker. They got a striker. You needed midfielders. You got midfielders. You needed fullbacks. You got fullbacks. Like, they need a goalkeeper heading this year. They got a goalkeeper. They've continuously plugged these holes. So now, I mean, this is pretty much near, if not the final form of this Whitecaps team. Well, at this point, you've committed to Sartini, and he's done well to this stage. You ride it out and see where it is. And it's, say, something where if they end up maybe, you know, failing spectacularly, then you look at a new coach. But I think also part of the reason for their success has been, you know, what Sartini has done. Sometimes it has been a bit on the experimental, a bit on the wacky side, but also he has shown to learn from his mistakes for the most part and progress. And if he can continue doing that with this team, I mean, he's got a heck of a group, so no reason why he can't push for more silverware and maybe a run.
And for Mayan Silberstein, where do you see the Caps finishing your regular season realistically? I really want to get excited about this team, but don't know where to set my expectations, and I don't want to set them too high. But this is definitely the best team we've ever had in a long time, and I can see us making a deep playoff run. And I think the Whitecaps can finish top four, maybe realistically is just outside that top four, like a fifth or sixth in the West. But that's on a lot of their road struggles. Can they turn things around on the road, as well as a bit of a slow start to the season that they were playing well in, but they weren't necessarily getting those results at home or on the road. But I think they would go into the playoffs as a team in that fifth or sixth spot that you don't want to play against, because they're probably higher quality than that. The same goes for, you know, a team like Miami, who might go into the playoffs as the ninth seed, and they're certainly not worthy of being a ninth seed at this point.
And I think top four is achievable for Vancouver. The West is such a chaotic ground, and I think on paper, Vancouver should be in the top four. You look at the roster they've put together, they've added. So it's really in their hands. I mean, we'll see how their road form is, because, you know, they've shown signs of improvement as of late, but also still just, what, one road MLS game all season. But yeah, I mean, even just as much you look at the numbers, you look at the roster, their expected goal difference or expected goals for, although their expected goals against has been a bit all over the map at times this season. It's in the Whitecaps' hands is what I'd say. I'd say every time I look at the standings, I look at this roster, I don't see anything other than a top four as an unrealistic finish. And that would be huge, because that gives you a bit of a, you know, more chance at home playoff advantage. But obviously with the new three games playoff system, it's a bit different, but especially in the later rounds, if you can win that first round, finishing top four will help immensely. So I think that's the goal, I'd say.
And getting into our CPL roundup as well, Cavalry defeated Forge 3-0 on Friday. Atletico Ottawa and York United played to a thrilling 3-3 draw. Vancouver drew 0-0 with Valor, with that result seemingly penciled in before the match even took place, while the HFX Wanderers fell 2-1 to Pacific FC. And when you're looking at the CPL table, it's going to be an exciting end to the season because each team has played 18 matches. Pacific atop right now with 32 points. And then Calvary right there behind, 30 points. And it's really a tight race for the title all the way down to, you could even see HFX on 25 points making a run for it with some good form. So certainly exciting times in the CPL.
Yeah, you look at the revised playoff format, and I had my doubts about it just because I thought that it would maybe water down the competition, but you're now seeing kind of what it's done for clubs like Halifax. And I mean, even Valor, like, I know they're 8 points out of it right now, but with the roster they have, the fact that a couple of years ago, it looked like HFX was going to lock down a top four place and then lost it on the final day to York United. You could easily see Valor maybe climbing their way back into it. Like, they haven't been awful this season. They just can't seem to score goals. That's their biggest problem. So it's very competitive top to bottom. And that's what I think we wanted to see, is that every single game now is pretty competitive, even games Vancouver's playing in. Like, I know they've had a couple of pretty lopsided defeats, but otherwise they've held their own. They've played some decent stuff. It's been a very competitive league this year. It's been great to see, and I'll hold my hands up and say I was wrong about the revised playoff format. It's done exactly what I think the league wanted it to do in terms of giving more teams a shot. You're seeing certain teams going for it. Look at the signings the Wanderers have made over the last few weeks, and you can see that they're really trying to mount a bit of a run here, so it's good to see that.
Meanwhile, Ozaze de Rosario is banned 1 month for a positive THC test from October 1, 2022. Sanctioned by the Canadian Center for Ethics in Sport. THC is included on the WADA list of prohibited substances. The CSIS notes that WADA's prohibited list is not affected by changes in the Canadian law that legalized cannabis. And from Searle, Christopher Searle, why are these bans coming so long after the tests are administered? How does the appeal process work, and why doesn't the national drug body adjust what's legal versus what isn't, example, cannabis? And when you adopt the WADA list of prohibited drugs, that is straightforward. You can't be making any sort of exceptions to that, and that goes across Canadian sport. So when you're looking at basically any Canadian athlete, it applies to that, especially when they're competing at either an international level or within a league such as the CPL or even the CFL, when you're using the CSIS as your governing body for drug testing. It's unfortunate. I don't think it should be necessarily a banned substance, but it is something that needs to be kind of looked at, and whether the CPL and CSIS maybe create a separate list. CSIS has too much to deal with for a CPL player, but the CPL could potentially look at a separate list of prohibited substances, but that's another cost that they would have to undertake. And while we cover the World Cup, the CPL announced a new exceptional young talent category. This allows teams to sign two additional under 18 domestic players outside of their 23-man roster. Vancouver FC immediately used the slots on 18-year-old defender James Cameron and 16-year-old TJ Tahid. Forge also used one slot on midfielder Kadeem Kane. And from Johnny Lower at Jay on the Spot 12, what are your thoughts on the CPL introducing an exceptional young talent category? Happy if it gives young players more choice and leverage when it comes to either trialing in Europe or joining an MLS team / academy.
Yeah, it's great. Anytime you can give more opportunities to young players, especially when it doesn't, I don't want to say take up a roster spot, but I'm sure some teams are looking at the finite amount of spots that they have and they say, well, look, we need to start getting some wins on the field here. Yes, we need to meet an under 21 minutes quota, but we also got to fill it in with some proven players here to be able to get wins on the pitch, put bums in seats, as one of our former premiers loved to say, and then go from there. But I do like the fact that they are at least giving the teams that flexibility to be able to add a couple more players to the mix, because you've seen what the likes of TJ Tahid have been able to do despite their young age, right? Like, he's looked really, really good in the games he's played for Vancouver. So why not give more opportunities to players like him? And this is a good way to do it. So good on the CPL for being able to give another opportunity for young players to get on rosters as well as on the pitch.
And from Matthew H, with it being past the halfway point in the CPL season, which players have surprised you the most? Any players that could jump to MLS or abroad if their form and development keeps rising? And I think one player that you have to look at, and you always have to look at him in the CPL, is Manny Aparicio, as well as Sean Young. With the way he's been playing, I could see Sean Young potentially moving to the Vancouver Whitecaps as a Russell Tybert replacement in the offseason. But yeah, you look at those sort of those top performers, especially the ones that have been around for a little while, and a move seems to be kind of beckoning for them. And you can also look at a guy like TJ Tahid or any of the exceptionally young players in the league as well, and whether they can potentially make a jump to an MLS Next Pro or an MLS Academy, because that might be the most advantageous move for their careers.
Really, the one player who I think surprised me the most, just because I never expected him to be that good, was Daniel Nimick. Like, I never expected a 22-year-old with little pro experience, especially at this level, to be such a settled fixture on a CPL backline and to thrive that much. He's done so well that he's a Defender of the Year candidate for sure. And he does everything. Wins aerials, ground duels, distributes, progressive passes up the yin-yang. It's lovely to see that. And even when you look back early in the season when the Wanderers were struggling and they were chopping and changing their backline, and Patrice Geiser was trying to figure out how should we set up here? Is it a back three with Christian Campagna in there? Does Campagna play fullback? Like, all those questions. The one constant was Nimick always looking really, really good. So now you add Daniil Henry to that mix of players, and you're thinking to yourself, Nimick is only going to grow from here, because what a player to learn from in Daniil Henry. Another one to point out for me, and this is maybe a bit of an honorable mention, Matteo Debrienne, to settle in that quickly at left back and to be that important to Valor's attacking platform says a lot for a 21-year-old learning a new position. Yes, Valor haven't been racking up the points and the goals have dried up, but that doesn't take away from Debrienne's performances. And I've also been somewhat shocked on the flip side that I think Rubens Pacias hasn't kicked on. Patrice Bernier reported the other day that he still has interest from abroad and MLS, but his underlying numbers are down across the board. Surely that's due to him not starting as much and swapping positions, mainly playing on the wing. I know Taron Campbell has done really, really well up front. He's got 8 goals, I believe it is. But underlying numbers-wise, and even sometimes in games, I honestly wonder sometimes if Taron Campbell's even the right option and Pacias would be the superior choice, because it might end up helping both of them and also helping Forge kick on, because we've seen Forge, they've picked up steam again as of late, but they've been a lot more inconsistent the last few weeks. You wonder, maybe that's one tweak that could be a win-win situation. So those would be the three players I'd look at on opposite ends of the spectrum.
Yeah, certainly a few players to look at across the board. I mean, Sean Young has been one where he started strong, maybe slowed down a bit, but just you look at the improvement he's had in his game. Yeah, you look over at Cavalry. I think Eric Cubs has been one who's just stood out immediately as a ball player, can play CB, can play in midfield. I think that sort of profile is crucial. And, you know, he's just very technical for someone of his size. You look elsewhere, Ryan Yesley for Valor. I just think he's been, I mean, the numbers speak for themselves with him, and even, you know, just some of the shots he's been able to save. He'll certainly keep working on his distribution, but, you know, impressive, his shot stopping. Yeah, he elsewhere, Dan Nimick's a great shout. He's someone who's grown every game. Like, every time I watch him, he looks like a whole new player. You look at as well, like someone like an Aiden Daniels, the way he's grown as a creative player, the consistency he's added to his game week in, week out. Yeah, I think there's something where there's definitely some intriguing profiles, and I think it'll be intriguing to see how Canadian MLS teams look at it, because as we're seeing domestic depth, there's a lot of value of it, both for the Canadian Championship and also just to round out your roster. And, you know, in MLS, there aren't, you know, U21, U23 minute restrictions. So it'll be intriguing to see what's that next generation of guys heading up to MLS looks like. Because we've seen kind of both sides of it, where maybe you get a Lowell Wright who's, you know, younger, 18, 19, he makes that jump up to MLS Next Pro. And maybe you wonder if a bit more seasoning in CPL could have helped, because then you see guys like Joel Waterman, right? A bit older, you make that jump up and ends up being a huge ad for Montreal. So I think that's intriguing for especially guys in those mid-20s, right? Like a Nimick, like a Young. Well, not, they're not mid-20s, you know, more early to mid-20s, but those are still someone where sometimes as we can get drawn into, yeah, they're not U21, so therefore they're old. But no, guys like Young at 22,
Nimic at 22. Those guys can definitely make the jump up, and I'm intriguing to see how that goes if they do get that opportunity, if they keep putting up performances like that.
And from Giancarlo Morelli, how come we don't see more U21 loanees from MLS clubs to the CPL during the transfer window? I, for one, kind of expected that we would see Thomas Asal get loaned out, considering that he's basically been demoted to the Whitecaps' third keeper.
I mean, not an under 21, but yeah, certainly someone who could have. I think part of it is just the fact that there's three layers to this, at least to me, in that it takes two to tango, so clubs have to be willing to send players to those clubs and then have the CPL clubs want to take them. So Ottawa, for example, has taken on some loans and it's helped them immensely. It's helped the players immensely. Valor these days seems to be the opposite, and that's fine, to each their own, right? But yes, it would help some teams if they're under 21 minutes, but it would be doing the players a disservice as well if they just went there to fill a quota. And that's not what you want from this. You need them to gel tactically, gel with the other players. There needs to be a clear development plan for them, because you can't just send a guy on loan and say, all right, go play. Like, there has to be some tangible plan in place. And I think that's part of the reason why we're maybe not seeing it, is that some of these clubs just don't feel like they want to take on a new young player on loan who may not be there in a few months' time, right? Because the MLS club might want him back for their preseason and then see how he performs maybe in the first few months of the campaign next year.
And from Star at Hemalurgi, why has the CPL failed to export good attacking talent to better leagues? Defenders, midfielders, and goalkeepers seem to do fine, but every forward has flopped to some extent after being transferred from the CPL. And I think that can go up to just playing against better defenders, and you're shut down in different ways than you are in the CPL.
Yeah, it's a bit of an interesting question, because I mean, the thing as well with defenders and goalkeepers, it's the adjustment's different, so to speak, because as well, like when you're going up to a different level, it's also harder as a defender to kind of get minutes right off the bat, because coaches usually, you know, you have to build trust. You're not getting those opportunities right off the hop, right? You're having to learn the system. You're having to learn the tactics. Sometimes you see defenders like Joel Waterman, for example. He goes to Montreal. There were some injuries in year one and he played, but really he didn't become a full nailed on regular till fall of 2021, just because that's the time it takes to learn and to trust and get your opportunity. Whereas with forwards, I think that's also some of the issue that you see with teams buying forwards, is that it's a very instant gratification thing. Like, if your striker is not scoring right away, if you're already thinking, oh, we got to look at the next. And I mean, that's also the nature of the business, right? Goals win games. So you're always going to be looking for goals, whereas defense, right? It's a process. It's not as sexy. You're going to be taking your time with that. So yeah, I'd say it's as much just the output as well. Cause when you're making you know, especially in the forward market, teams are always looking for flashy pieces. So say if you're, you know, if you're a forward going to an MLS team out of the CPL, you might be competing with DP strikers, DP wingers, because, you know, that's what the sort of output that players are going to be putting on teams. So yeah, it is a bit of an interesting theory, right? That the guys like, yeah, Dominik Zator goes and shines right away in Poland. It is worth noting, but I also do think that's just the transfer market in general. Like, forwards are such a weirdly valued commodity. And I mean, that's why they're always priced way more than everyone else. And that's because no one has quite figured out that exact science yet.
And to be fair, Marco Bustos is doing all right at Värnamo. He's not starting regularly, but he's still getting into games and doing decently well. And by all accounts, Ronan Kratt is impressing at Werder Bremen. He actually scored today for the reserves. So some hit, some don't, because for every Easton Ongaro or Alejandro Diaz or Tristan Borges was maybe a little bit unlucky due to the pandemic and coaching changes affecting things. For every one of those guys, you have the Bustoses, you have the Kratts who are going to go over there, get a chance and take it. So it's no different to any other position, I feel. It's just such a small sample size to go off of that, obviously, with so many defenders and in some cases midfielders, goalkeepers making the jump. Yeah, you're going to see a bit more success just because of the pure volume. You also have to consider, too, that MLS rosters up until very recently don't like to spend a lot of money on defenders, and especially some that they might consider depth pieces. So that's probably another reason why you're going to see more defenders making that jump. But overall, I don't think it's completely fair to say that, you know, the CPL's failed to export good attacking talents, especially when we've already got two that are have started at least their European adventures decently well.
And from JC Partidas, at JC Partidas, I'm wondering why Manuel Garicho is still playing at the Canadian Premier League level. It's not that I don't like players with his quality in the league, but shouldn't he be playing at MLS or even Europe?
I think for Aparicio, I think he just missed the boat a little bit in terms of age, in terms of when he broke out, because he's 28 next month, and he broke out at Pacific when he was, what, 25, turning 26? That's not to say he can't move abroad still, especially if a Canadian club is looking for a cheap domestic option in midfield. Like, Ben, you mentioned Sean Young maybe going to the Whitecaps. Why not Manny Aparicio as a possible cheap, proven domestic midfield option, right? Like, if you want to go that route as well. Not sure the Whitecaps would do it, but I'm just saying that's a potential option. I feel like if Aparicio was still like 26 or under, he maybe could have gone the Bustos route. So it might just be a case of just unfortunate timing for him. But he's certainly good enough to, at the very least, crack an MLS roster.
And from Jay Hyde at Joel Hedebrick, do you see Ryan Yesley getting invited to a CanMNT camp in the near future? I don't see it.
I'd say, you know what, he's an intriguing prospect, though, because, like, again, it's something where, like, first, like, this, first of all, it's a bit of a football unicorn, like a 6'7" goalkeeper who can get down well, who can move. Like, he's not horribly old. Algeria's shown interest in him. I've seen reports circulating that, I mean, Algeria's keeping an eye on him the same way they've looked at someone like a Mo Farsi. I think it's something where why not? Because I think he's definitely someone where you're looking at this current crop of goalkeepers. He's absolutely someone who can move up to that next level. He's still like a good age for a goalkeeper. Again, just that profile that he brings. I mean, it's going to be tough for him to get thrown into a CanMNT camp, no doubt, right? You look at the depth of goalkeeper. I mean, Borean's still around, but, you know, St. Clair, Crepo, Sirwa, McGill. It's going to be a crowded net, no doubt. But also, like, it's something, especially if Yesley can make that jump to that next level, he's going to have something about him that will be worth having a look. So maybe it's not as much of, yeah, you're throwing him into a senior camp against Japan, but maybe in a January camp in the fall, in January camps, if those ever come back and you're looking for three goalkeepers to round out your roster, depending on where Yesley's at, I feel like he'd be a fascinating name to take a look at, especially with that Algeria interest kind of looming.
And from Oz Sweeney at Oz Sweeney 4, after a few seasons, the quality in the CPL continues to grow, but the marketing and crowds continue to lack. What would you like to see teams and the league do as a whole to give this league a needed boost? I think a lot of it has to do with getting on one of the major broadcasters.
Yeah, I think that's a big obstacle, because the more eyeballs you give it, then obviously the more people are going to see the product, and therefore they're going to be willing to go see the games. But clearly that's something that's not happening right now, so we just got to take what we can get in that regard. So I'd say separately to that, they need to be winning on the pitch, and we're seeing the effects that's had in markets like Pacific, where winning and targeting families on the island has led to bigger crowds at Starlight. I think what Vancouver FC is doing, like $5 beers, different promotional nights for the games, et cetera, is also very smart. Hook people in for one game, they might come back if they like the product. Another thing is to just be prevalent in your community. Like, when you go to the Victoria and especially Langford area, it's very obvious Pacific play there on the island based on all the ads you see around the various neighborhoods. It's obvious that the Wanderers play in Halifax with everything draped in the logo and sky blue. That being said, though, I mean, attendance figures are solid this year. You got something like 3K plus across all the markets apart from York, and then I think Valor is still lagging a bit relative to what they could be getting, but more wins could help there, and maybe just overall a more entertaining product. Like, if they start scoring a few more goals, that could help them. But those would be the things off the top of my head that would help. And it's no different to any of the other conversations we've had in the past. It's all about just targeting your local markets, getting wins on the pitch, and just enticing people to want to come to your games, especially in the markets where you're already an established brand. How do you capitalize after the sort of new car smell wears off?
Yeah, that's the challenge, really. It's especially, right, like, how do you able to grab a foothold, you know, be in the community, even just beyond winning, right? Because, I mean, winning always helps, but I guess how can you, what are the little things you can do to draw those fans in? I think as well, for example, like for Vancouver, for example, as a new franchise or a new club, I think, you know, a big challenge is, okay, how can you draw in that local community as well, right? Because that's the kind of balance you want to, you know, be able to attract, of course, the soccer fans in a community, but also, you know, if you look at Vancouver, there's a intriguing population in Surrey and Langley and across the board, where if you can tap into that in any form, and you know, you've also seen that with promotion nights, they're certainly pushing, right? It's something where it takes time. But yeah, that's going to be the challenge, but especially with beyond the maybe mainstream access to the league, because in that case, when there's not that mainstream access, when you're not getting that boost in that regard, you're going to need to take a foothold locally, and that takes time. That takes time to establish yourselves, to have those sorts of moments, and that can be a growth process. And you've seen it in some markets, right? Like Ottawa, it's been a bit of a slow burn, but they've been building a good thing over there, and I think that's a good example of what that patience can sometimes yield.
And from Archer Lachinsky at Archer Lachinsky3, with hashtag Messi Mania taking MLS by storm, what realistic big name aging star would you like to see come to the CPL so we could experience our Beckham moment? Personally, I'd like to see Giovinco sign a 1-year deal with York United. The problem with that idea at the CPL level is I don't think it works, because the only reason it works in MLS is because you're bringing in world famous stars. You're bringing in David Beckham, Lionel Messi, David Villa, Frank Lampard, Steven Gerrard. Even if those players don't perform at the top level, these are players that people know from following the top leagues in Europe. And bringing in, say, a Giovinco doesn't necessarily do that, because TFC fans, it might not even hit their radar screens that Giovinco signs with York United, because York United so often falls off a lot of the radar screens of TFC fans. I think back to the first year of the CPL when Valor was linked to Diego Forlan, and maybe that could have been something to bring some people out with the way that he performed at the 2010 World Cup and just sort of the name recognition there. But unless you're looking at someone who's like Wayne Rooney now, kind of thing, in his 40s, well past his acceptable playing age, I don't see it necessarily working for the CPL.
One name that I think would be kind of awesome would be like Camilo signing for Vancouver. That would be cool. But like
that'd be better than Giovinco.
That could be the absolute limit you would hit, though, because Camilo's 35. He's had a couple of serious knee injuries. If he wants to wind down, maybe, you know, retire in Vancouver or something, because Lord knows he has the money to do it now. But he still wants to keep playing, still wants to keep fit and earn a bit of a salary before calling it quits, then that could be a route to do it. But I think like what you said is spot on. So if you're looking at, you know, a decade from now or whatever, when the CPL becomes a bit more established, has a bit more money behind it, hopefully anyways, I think something that could be cool is like in 12 years, Jonathan David signs for Ottawa, or Fonzie joins Edmonton if Edmonton ever gets a club again.
Yeah, and I think it's different as well, just because in MLS, the structure, right, is like, the idea of a Beckham moment or a Messi is like you are completely altering the fabric of your just the finance, like it's just the money, right? Like you're like the part of me that you're literally like altering the rules to fit Beckham or Messi in under the cap. Like you're throwing a significant amount of resources. I mean, it's something where you kind of get that short term impact of a Beckham mania or a Messi mania. But yeah, it's something where for CPL, especially where you're, you know, it's different financial constraints, you're not as established, it takes time to build up for that. So I think if you're looking at players who could help bring that now, I love the signings like a Daniel Henry, someone who that's a national team, you know, player, that's someone who's recognizable. That's huge. You saw the reception he gets in Halifax. I think those are the sort of signings that teams could be looking at. Like, I think for me, the no-brainer that I'm surprised he hasn't been picked up is like a David Weatherspoon. That's someone who's still a free agent. That's someone who played at a World Cup this past year. Yeah, he's not going to be, you know, recognizable to the stage of a Giovinco, or of course you go to some of the big names you might want to throw out. But still, that's a Canadian national team player, and that could also be just as important for the league, because you hear about how Henry has helped a Dan Nimick, someone who maybe has ambitions of one day playing for Canada. Guys like Weatherspoon as well, who have played there, have been in that environment, can also help the growth of, because remember, this is CPL. There's a lot of younger players that, you know, there's a lot of U21s, a lot of U23s, those sorts of Canadian veterans that have been there, done that. that it can help them to have sorts of players like that around them.
And getting into our Canadians Abroad mailbag and roundup, the Northern Football Podcast is proudly partnered with Canucks Abroad. Find the full Canadian player pool and daily schedules for Canadians in action at canucks-abroad.ca. We're still waiting on transfers if they come for Jonathan David and Tejan Buchanan. Lille has stated that unless a big offer comes in, they have no need to sell David this summer. He's been recently linked to Spurs and Juventus as Harry Kane and Dusan Vlahovic replacements, respectively. From On the Rise FC at On the Rise FC, with Jonathan David running out of clubs to join this summer, do you think he stays or leaves? I personally think he stays unless Spurs come for him. And there might be Spurs coming for him now, considering Harry Kane has finally signed with Bayern Munich.
Yeah, but there's still a big if in that regard. I think he's staying personally. Lille aren't budging on their $65 million asking price. His wage demands are reportedly quite high, so only a handful of clubs could afford him. Inter already said he's too expensive, so that rules them out. Man United soured on him as a player, then signed Rasmus Højlund. Chelsea chose Nicholas Jackson. AC Milan got Noah Okafor from Salzburg. RB Leipzig picked up Loie Openda from Lens, and then Benjamin Sesko as well. Dortmund have Moukoko and Haller, so they were probably out. Bayern, as we know, splashed $100 million plus on Kane. Napoli could still pivot if Osimhen leaves, which I think seems unlikely now. And Spurs might return, but they weirdly seem to be in on Romelu Lukaku as well. And then there's Juventus, who looked into it, but they need to sell Dusan Vlahovic first. And they're already in pretty dire straits financially. And Brighton sniffed around too, but they have Evan Ferguson and João Pedro, so even they're ruled out now. Therefore, all signs point to him staying, unless Spurs, or perhaps PSG, because maybe they'll end up needing a forward if they really do end up being firm with Mbappe, which I highly doubt they will. But other than that, I think he will be staying. He was more consistent last year, so I think if he repeats that this season, he can get that move next summer at 24, and no damage will be done. There's nothing wrong with him staying at Lille. It's just maybe a bit disappointing from the fan perspective of, we expected him to leave. He was supposed to get a step up. He's maybe outgrown Lille. He's maybe even outgrown Liga in a lot of ways. It's ready for he's ready for his next challenge. We need Canadian players playing at the absolute highest level, high pressure environments they possibly can be playing in. So from that point of view, yeah, it would be disappointing, but these things happen all the time. There's still a few weeks left in the window. Who knows? We've seen what the Moises Caicedo stuff has happened. A lot of weird shit can happen in the transfer market. So it's possible something still happens, but all signs point to him staying just based on everything that's happened.
I mean, we'll see with Tottenham, right? Like the thing is, they just did get a hefty chunk of coin. I'd find it hard to believe that they'd get that much money and then they'd go and turn around and get like a Lukaku on loan, for example. So, I mean, the big issue with Jonathan David has been the price tag. And I mean, that's something where the thing is, Daniel Levy and Spurs have been through this before when they sold like a Gareth Bale, and, you know, maybe they tried to, they tried to spread it out by getting 6-7 players with the Bale money, and that, it didn't turn out so great for them. Maybe they'll realize like, screw it. Sometimes you get money, you have to go punch for punch and get a guy like a David who's 24. Yeah, he might be a bit heftier at a 60 mil, but you know, you can buy that and still have 40 million left over to shore up areas of your squad. I'd be surprised. I feel like it's something where I'd like to think Tottenham will have learned their lesson from an instance like when they sold Bale. So it remains to be seen. All I know is this striker market is extremely complicated, and we'll see how the cookie crumbles.
Buchanan has started in Bruges' first four matches of the season and has been linked to Burnley in the Belgian press. And from Eddie Ng, where will Tejan Buchanan start the season? What happened to the Inter rumors? And I think he's going to be starting the season right where he is with Club Bruges.
Because Denzel Dumfries is still at Inter, so there's no need to replace him. And that was the plan for Tejan. If Dumfries gets sold, Tejan comes in to replace him. That's why they reached the verbal agreement. And that hasn't happened, obviously. So, and it's ditto at Napoli as well. They expected to sell Kvicha Kvaratskhelia, and that didn't happen. So the options are limited there. It's unfortunate, but it happens. You have to keep in mind as well that this is going to be the first time that Tejan has started a season at Bruges properly without an injury. Because he got hurt to start last year, missed a few months, and now with fitness and a permanent coach in Ronnie Dela, he could really push on here. So there may be a bit of a silver lining to him staying at Bruges, even if it's for another 4 or 5 months.
Some notable players already in action in Europe as well. Ike Ugbo scored and assisted for Cardiff City in his debut as they drew 2-2 with Leeds United. Ismaël Koné logged 30 minutes off the bench in Watford's first two matches in the Championship and EFL Cup. Scott Kennedy logged the full 90 in his Wolfsburger debut as they beat Blau-Weiss Linz 2-1 in the Austrian Bundesliga. Milan Borjan started for Slovan Bratislava in their first leg against Maccabi Haifa in the third round of Champions League qualifying. Derek Cornelius had 82 minutes at left back for Malmö in their 3-0 win over Halmstadt. Jane Nelson scored again in Rosenberg's 2-1 win over Hearts in the Europa Conference League qualifying. Theo Corbenu picked up his third assist in as many games as Grasshoppers won 3-1 against Liam Miller's Basel. Miller went the full 90 on the left wing for Basel. In League's Cup action, Kamal Miller and Inter Miami defeated FC Dallas on penalties in a wild contest, one of the best MLS contests or League's Cup contests that you could possibly ever imagine. Miller converted his penalty as Miami will now face Charlotte in the quarterfinals. Dane Sinclair helped Minnesota United edge Toluca on penalties, winning 4-2 in the shootout, and they'll play Nashville. Speaking of which, Lucas McNaughton got the start and Jacob Schaffelberg entered in the 63rd minute as Nashville beat Club America on penalties in another crazy game. The entire League's Cup's been absolutely entertaining. Marc-Anthony Kay and the New England Revolution bowed out at the hands of Querétaro on penalties. Kay started and went 57 minutes in Monday's loss. Liam Fraser joined FC Dallas from Dynes with contract options for 2024 and 2025, as TFC got a little bit fleeced in that deal as well. And as we're recording the podcast, Canavente eligible Luca Colioso has the start for Burnley. And from Sean C at Sean underscore C2, is there anything that can realistically be done about MLSC and Montreal's obvious indifference to the women's pro game? At a time when overseas leagues are being propelled by their men's team's involvement, it's a significant hindrance for Canada. I think Montreal will get there with how they've already partnered with PAF Quebec and their general involvement and seeming desire to be involved with women's soccer. It just doesn't seem like they are interested in taking that flyer on Project 8, whereas DFC is dead in the water when it comes to women's sport, it looks like.
Yeah, I mean, the not NWSL even just soccer thing was in the ether for a bit. I know that that's long been floated out there, but other than that, yeah, they haven't really seemed to be interested. Saputo, I highly doubt would want to start another club, especially when CF Montreal are in so much debt. I don't know if he'd be interested in doing that himself personally. But on the bright side, you do have HFX Wanderers starting their own women's club, which is a step in the right direction. I'm sure other clubs are going to start following suit. So that is at least a sign in the right direction. But as much as, you know, some people may want to have that independence, you can't deny the impact that these clubs like the big English clubs, even the clubs in South America and Mexico, have had on the women's game in those respective countries. Like, it's grown immensely because of the investment they've put into it. That would be the easiest way out. But if you can get some investors who are going to be committed for the next 5 or so years, even longer than that, then that also works too. Like, there's no linear pathway to getting a women's league started in this country, especially when it's already difficult enough to start a soccer league in Canada as it is, let alone a women's one.
Yeah, I think the MLSC one feels like it's been the biggest surprise, because it's, you know, it's something where the fact that there's not even, like, you know, a women's pathway, right? Not even an academy team, or because, you know, you look on the Whitecaps side, there is the Rex Academy. You know, now they've pushed to League One, and now obviously the commitment to a pro team. You even look at Montreal, where, yeah, they haven't committed to a pro team yet, but within the last year, they've taken huge strides. You know, they've taken the Quebec equivalent of Rex, and all of a sudden they've put a bit of investment. All of a sudden that team's doing great in Ligue 1 Quebec, and, you know, they're seeing the fruits of that. You just wonder, like, with Toronto, the fact that they haven't put anything has been the big surprise, because they're really, I mean, based on the money they've thrown around, they've clearly been the richest and most ambitious club in Canada on the men's side. You only wonder what, you know, a fraction of that could look like on the women's side in terms of just even, again, it's not even just the pro pathway, it's even just the developmental aspect of it. So yeah, I think it's absolutely been a big surprise. And I mean, it's good to see more and more pro teams step up. I think Halifax, that's a good start as well to have them in League One Atlantic, and hopefully some other pro teams continue to follow suit, because I think it's something where
especially in Canada where the system is fractured in that regard. It'd be nice to, you know, get that sort of get all the pieces working together to help the growth of overall the overall game, but certainly the women's game.
And from Star at Hamilurgy, could you guys give your best 11 for Quebec, Ontario, and BC, or maybe spread it over multiple episodes? Players eligible in accordance to the FIFA rule, players like Bounou work. And Peter, you came up with a starting lineup. I came up with some subs for a BC team, if you want to take us through your starting 11.
Sure, yeah. So this was all off the top of my head. And it also very much occurred to me that if we were doing an all-time 11, the BC 11 could actually win like an intra-provincial competition, because they have that many options, especially a goalkeeper alone. But anyway, in terms of active players right now, my 11 is as follows. So Callum Irving in goal, then from right to left in the back line, and keep in mind this is BC-born players, Alistair Johnston, Joel Waterman, Caden Chung, and then Jake Ruby. In the midfield, we got Alessandro Hojabrapur, Patrick Metcalf, and Sean Young. And then we're going to go with the front three of Brandon Cambridge, Taron Campbell, and Simon Colin. There were some possibilities in there that could have come in, which you'll probably hear now on the bench, which I'm sure Ben will read out. But when I had to pick an 11 off the top of my head, that is what I came up with. If you guys have other suggestions, please send them our way at Northern Football, at Galindo PW, at bsteiner00. I don't even know. You have so many handles now on Instagram and freaking Threads and shit. I don't even remember all your handles anymore off the top of my head. But yeah. Feel free to fire away with your BC 11s. We'll do the Ontario next week. We'll do the Quebec the week after that, just to kind of spread it out.
On the bench, first of all, it's at BenSteiner00. And on the bench, I've got Marcus Haber, David Norman Jr., Paris G, Isaac Boomer is the backup goalkeeper, Matthew and Michael Baldissimo, Ben Fisk, and Noah Verhoeven. You get really into kind of the top CPL players when you're looking at a BC 11, especially as the province has kind of dried up in player development. But I'm sure that when we take a look at Ontario and Quebec, we might see a lot less of the Canadian Premier League.
Ontario is going to absolutely dominate. So will Quebec. Quebec has a lot of damn good players too. So this will be fascinating to put together over the coming weeks.
And for Matthew H at KenMNT100 always, here's a Ben question. I know the U Sports season hasn't started yet, but are there any players who may be worth watching or learning more about? And my mind goes right to Jada Thompson. She led League One Ontario in goal scoring this season with the Woodbridge Strikers. She's coming into a UBC team, and I know I will talk my wit's end off about UBC, but they have some interesting players. And Jada Thompson is kind of atop that list with the form that she's shown so young. She played a year with UBC, but was very much sort of shadowing Daniel Steer and Catalin Tolnai last year. And the plan this year is for her to be the main striker for the Thunderbirds. So I would say that she has the potential to do quite well in the women's game. And then when you look at the men's game, I'd love for Michael Henman to get an opportunity at the CPL level after this season. Just because he's been absolutely cooking for the Victoria Highlanders and going back now to the UNBC Timberwolves. And last year he set the record for most goals scored in a Canada West season. So I would say for him, and in terms of a team that you'd want to look at, probably the TMU Bold with the signings that they've been able to make with Colin Gander coming back from the Guelph Griffins and an experience with the HFX Wanderers, as well as U Sports MVP Chris Campoli. So some exciting players across the board, and that TMU Bold men's soccer team probably one to keep an eye on and one to check out that if you're in the Toronto area. And that's all we've got for this episode of the Northern Football Podcast. For Alex and Peter, I've been Ben. Make sure to follow us all on social media and check back next week for episode 135 of the Northern Football Podcast.